And welcome. We are really happy that you are here to our first edition of our Learning Lab. And of course, we will hope that you will leave this meeting enriched and inspired. This is, as I said, the first edition of the Learning Lab, where dance movement therapy and dance for health joins together, because we are sure that we can not only have fun dancing together, but learn a lot from and inspire each other as well. So my name is Brigitte Züger, and I am the director of Zoe School for Dance Movement Therapy in Basel, Switzerland. Our training is the first training in Switzerland that is on master level to gain the higher Swiss Federal Diploma after 4 years of training and 4 years and 3,000 hours of training. We are happy to offer our students, and I give you now a little bit an introduction, a very tiny mini introduction to Zoe School, which then you, it makes sense to you why we do this lab. We offer our students movement-based experiential learning, also in theory classes, as much as it is possible. Our goal is to train evidence-oriented and evidence-informed DMTs. And that level is very new in Switzerland. So we must make acquaintance with that new, or Switzerland has to make a little bit acquaintance with this new situation, this new standard of dance movement therapists. We also give a great importance that our students have the ability to feel comfortable with the research practice transfer. We want this issue, the research practice transfer, we want this issue to really become bigger and more familiar, more important and more obvious, especially in the healthcare community. That is really crucial for us to be in the healthcare system, or to for us, the DMTs in Switzerland, to stay in the healthcare system, because we are in the healthcare system at the moment. Means that our sessions are being paid by the healthcare system. And I know we have a very privileged situation, but I think, like for all the countries worldwide, it is very important that we go a step forward and let the community know what we do, how we do it, and that we have a huge body of evidence. That's the reason why we want to open these labs to the bigger community, and that is for this time now in the Learning Lab U. And in the Moving Lab, we expand the community even more. We invite patient groups, and we also invite their doctors, their nurses, their psychologists, all of their health care, their health professionals, and even their family, the people who live with them, the people who are in contact with them on an everyday basis. The core team who built that lab was Rebecca Barnstaple, Cecilia Fontanesi, and myself. The origin of the lab was Rebecca teaching at Zoe School. That was last winter. That was exactly a year ago. Rebecca teaches research in practice. And as what I got from that, they had a really inspiring teaching and visionary discussions. And all of a sudden, the students and Rebecca came with the idea, hey, Brigitte, let's do something. And that was actually the beginning of the lab. But then the lab needed a little bit of input of thoughts, so that it became that what it is now. And Cecilia joined us, I think it was this late summer or early summer sometimes. So we are a really good triangle. Each session, the format of the Learning Lab is that each session a presenter will introduce you to her or his work with the research practice factor. So we stay general, but we do not forget that research practice transfer. And today, and I'm so happy to say that, today it is Rebecca, followed by Cecilia this coming March on our second edition. And of course, and this is very important. We want to open the community. Of course, we are open to anyone who wants to present their work and put it in the light of the research practice transfer. So, and for today, the protocol is now Cecilia will introduce Rebecca. Then I will introduce, no, not introduce, I will interview Rebecca. We have a couple of questions that give you a little bit of insight on the behind the scene of the paper being created. So all the lows and ups and downs and whatever happens behind the scenes, so that you get a little bit an impression that there is a life behind the scenes and not only the like the slick and slim paper. So and then we'll have a Q&A, and we ask you to write your questions into the chat so that we can read it. And we will also record this session, and we will make a podcast, not the visuals. We will make a podcast of the session so that people can listen to it later who missed the event or who did not know about the event earlier. So we will cut out the first moments when I said, show your faces, we will cut that out. Okay, so I'll give the word to Cecilia to introduce Rebecca.
Thank you, Brigitte. So Rebecca is a dear friend of mine. We have known each other for more than 10 years, and she completed her PhD in dance studies with the graduate program at York in dance and neuroscience. And the paper she's going to present today comes from a collaboration that she has with a group called Improvement at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in the United States. And Rebecca also has studied and completed the training at Le Grand Ballet in Montreal, the dance therapy alternate route training, as well as she's completed two postdocs, one in psychology neuroscience at York and one at the International Institute for Critical Studies in Improvisation at Guelph University. And I'm proud and happy to say that she was just appointed as an assistant professor for creative arts, health and wellness, and cross-appointed with theater at Guelph University. So, Professor Bunce-Staple, passing the torch to you.
Thank you so much, Chachi, and thank you, Brigitte, for this nice context. So before I present the paper, the idea, as Brigitte shared, is that we're going to have a little conversation so you get a bit of the behind the scenes. So I'm going to answer a few questions. We'll have a little setup, and then I will do some slides, and we'll have a more kind of formal but brief presentation. And then I'm hoping that you will have questions and we can have some exchange. So back to Brigitte.
So it's very funny because Rebecca never introduced her to as Dr. Barnstaple. And now all of a sudden she is a professor. So Professor Barnstaple, when and in what context did you first become inspired to pursue this paper? And what was the key turning point that fueled your motivation? So this is a little bit, couple of questions,
Yeah.
but one question.
Well, this I think one thing to share with anyone who's done research, or if you haven't done research, this paper was cooking for a long time. It takes a long time to make a paper. So this actually started even before I was in Wake Forest during my PhD, which is more than 5 years ago. This practice that Cecilia mentioned, they were doing something called improvement. And I was very interested because they were using improvisational movement with people with Parkinson's and with people with Alzheimer's. And they were running a randomized control trial. So that means that they had to have a very rigorous protocol for what they were doing in the intervention. But this rigorous protocol came from improvisation. And it came from an improvisational practice that was developed in a community-facing class. So It was very fascinating to me and to Jesse and Christina, who were the two other people teaching this method. How is it possible to take something that is based in improvisation, set out a protocol that is rigorous enough to be approved for a randomized control trial without losing the essence? So for a long time, we had this idea of a paper that used to be called From Practice to Protocol. How do we go from the movement practice to making the research protocol? That's really was the inspiration for the paper and the thing that initiated the desire to create this research.
And what can you say anything about the key turning point that fueled your motivation?
The key turning point was really to publish the protocol so that it could be understood and replicated. Also, so if we were talking about what we were doing, people would understand. And we also thought this was important to share with other dance-based researchers, because in order for us to move the field of research forward, we have to be able to do different types of studies, including randomized control trials. So the idea of I had seen some less inspiring protocols. I thought this one was very good. So I wanted to get it out into the world because it seemed like it was rigorous, but it still had the heart of the practice inside of it.
That's nice. I was also talking about getting off into the community now, and that can be very motivational. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So did you ever consider to give up on
Yes.
the paper? Oh,
Frequently, frequently.
let us know the reasons. Let us know your suffering.
The main reason was, I know that at least Sylvie on this call will understand this, a real difficulty finding a place to publish this type of paper because it was about dance. So, there's many dance-based journals we could go towards, but we really wanted to talk about the research needs. And if we went towards a more research-based journal, this is a theoretical paper. It's a theoretical and perspective paper. And a lot of journals don't want to publish without publishing the study design and the data. But we had our data going somewhere else. So we really wanted to publish a piece that was about how did we do this? Why did we do this? Why is it important? And there are not a lot of places to publish that seemed like it would be a good platform for the idea, because we also wanted it to be accessible to people, scientific and medical researchers. So we didn't want to only publish in a dance journal that would only be read by a dance-based audience. So trying to find an appropriate place to publish, and even when we were working out how we were going to write the paper, thinking about what sections does the paper have? How is it constructed? Because different journals have different requirements. And there were many times we started going in a certain direction only to find, get a message back from an editor or say, well, no, that doesn't really fit the scope of this journal. So we would go in another direction. So there were many false starts, and actually for probably about a year, this just sat on a shelf because we didn't know where to send it.
And where was it finally published?
It was published in a Frontiers special edition, and that actually was the motivation to get it off the shelf. There were some researchers that were known to us that were working at this intersection of dance and science, and there was an invitation that came out for this special edition. And when we saw the scope of the special edition, we thought, ah, finally, here is a place we can think about this and hopefully publish it.
So my final question, which I hope will lead us into your presentation, is which contribution do you see this paper bringing to the larger field of creative art therapies? Understanding the broader impact and relevance for the research within the field, it's a very kind of like bright question. I would say, can you name a couple of reasons what is the contribution of the to the larger field of to the larger field of creating art therapies of the paper.
Yes, I think that there is a sad truth that that which is not reported risks being lost. And if we look at the existing literature on the impacts of dance, a lot of it is very sparse. And the elements that are not reported maybe are not replicated or are not assessed for efficacy. So the thing that we wanted to contribute was pushing researchers, even from outside of dance, to recognize the importance of some of the vital elements. And we wrote this initially from the perspective of practitioners. So Jesse and Christina and I, who made together the first draft of this paper, we were all in the practice, and we wanted people to know from the perspective of the people who are leading the dance intervention or study, what is critical to be included? What do we see? What do we feel matters here? Because if those things are not included in reporting, they may be forgotten or not considered as important or not considered as an active ingredient in what is effective. So, like, I will go through the paper. Actually, this is a great introduction. I will go through the paper and talk about the things we included, and why we created it that way. But it was really hopefully to ensure that going forward, not just for dance, all of the creative arts therapies are very holistic and include things that are a bit ineffable, the things that people say are magical, but these are real things. I had a lab meeting the other day with some students. I said, we need to measure the magic. Things like feeling a connection with the group, or the moments that there is that something comes up that is not measured with a balance scale. What is that, and how can we make sure it's not forgotten?
I think we should stay with that. How can we measure the magic? Measure the magic,
Magic.
yeah, I like that. So yeah, thank you very much. So do you need any help with your presentation? Or can you share your screen?
Here are my screens. I'm going to do. Everybody, do you see the screen?
Should be working. And if not, please let us know in the chat if you don't
So,
see.
Brigitte, you see it?
I do
Chechi?
see it, yes.
Perfect. Then everyone should see it. Okay. So I will this I'm going to try and keep this fairly short because I do want to have some exchange and conversation. But I'll go a little bit further and share some of the actual paper, and also some a bit more of the background of where it came from. So the paper is called This Time with Feeling, and if you're not from dance, this is something that people say when you are learning choreography, at least it was something that was said to me when I was dancing, which is once you know the steps, the choreographer or director might say, okay, this time with feeling, which means like you put yourself into the movement and you're not just marking the steps, you're really in the movement. And that full embodied acting through and with the movement is what I was trying to capture with this title. So it's full-bodied reporting of research on dance. And here is the special issue is called Dance, Embodied Agency and Neuroplasticity and Aging. It's from Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience, and it's open access. So that means there are 10 articles in this collection, and if you look it up, you can read all of them online for free. And there's some really nice other articles in this collection too. So I just wanted to share that as well. So as Chechi shared, and we were just talking, this came out of a collaboration with some really lovely folks in North Carolina. Winston-Salem, North Carolina is where Wake Forest University is. The smiling person in the center is Christina Soriano, and you'll see her talking to Christina Hugenschmidt. Christina Soriano is a dancer in the department, and she was in the Department of Dance at the time when this started. And Hugenschmidt is a neuroscientist and gerontologist. And they came together around this practice of improvement that Christina Soriano was doing, where she was using improvisational movement practices a lot of them from contemporary dance, in a community class and having really wonderful outcomes with people with Parkinson's. And Christina Hugenschmidt heard her talking about this and said, so this is a dance practice that people don't need to remember steps. And Christina Soriano said, yes. And she said, do you think it could work with people with memory loss? And that started a whole project that ended up in their first randomized control trial, which was looking at improvisational brain body movement as a way of supporting people with MCI, which is early stage of dementia. And then the other person in this picture is down on the left, head on the side. That's Jessie Laurita Spenglet, who was one of the first other people who became trained to deliver this intervention. And then I was the third person. Because originally, this was a practice that Christina Soriano developed and was just doing. But in order for it to be something that could be researched, we had to figure out, well, what is she doing? And that picture with Jessie and Christine in the bottom, the different colored papers, was where they started to look at the different elements of the practice and started to systematically identify them. And that became the first protocol for improvement. And then I was an outside person who was able to come in and learn from this protocol how to deliver this movement intervention in a way that was in line with what they had set out in their research design. So that's a little bit of background there. Oh, so what's interesting is that when I was there during my PhD, I worked on the first randomized control trial. And then after that, the group put in another application to do a follow-up randomized control trial. And this led to something that led to the paper. So there's like a few steps along the way here. We had wanted as a team to do a multi-site trial, which means that you are running the same protocol in, say, three different cities. However, it became clear that there was not enough fundamental information to do a meaningful comparison between sites. Things that we needed to know, so for instance, dose and frequency of a dance intervention were not known. So they ended up writing an application that was awarded successfully a $3 million NIH grant to do a 5-year randomized control trial to establish dose and frequency for dance. So that means how much dance, how many times a week. Anyone who's listening to this who knows the literature will know that it's quite common that it will be twice a week, but there has not been research to establish that that really is the best or like why that would be the case. It's more that's kind of what people just have done. So the study that's happening now as a follow-up to this is called iGroove, and I put the clinical trial ID there. They are enrolling. If you happen to know someone who is in that area with perceived memory loss, they are welcome to join the trial. When we wrote the application for that grant, and I was doing a postdoc at the time, and I was helped out with this to some extent. One of the things we had to do was a really extensive literature review to demonstrate why we needed to do this research. And the work that we did in putting that grant together ended up giving us enough information that we were able to publish part of the literature review. And the piece that I'm talking about today that I asked you to read, this time with feeling, is really meant as a companion piece to this one. So this one is Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. The first author is Paige Rice. And it's called Moving Towards a Medicine of Dance, a scoping review of characteristics of dance interventions targeting older adults and a theoretical framework. So we attempted to do a systematic review, but we could not because there was too much heterogeneity in the data. I'll explain what that means. So in pulling together literature to write this grant application, we found so many things that we could not compare because they were not the same across studies. So even within the like not huge field of dance research, There's high heterogeneity, so it doesn't match. Class frequencies range from 1 to 5 times a week. Class length can be from 30 to 120 minutes. An intervention can be from 2 weeks to 18 months. Studies often did not randomize participants. Sample sizes were small, and different comparisons were used, so different control conditions. And what is more, and anyone who does research will know the pain of this, there are so many different outcome measures used. We found over 50 different tests of cognition, 40 different dance forms, and 30 different tests for mobility. So, in order to compare meaningfully, you need to have more similarity in the things that people are doing and reporting and measuring. So, as an example of that, okay. Here is the distribution of dosing parameters. So where the thing gets wider, that means that's where there was the biggest concentration. So for frequency, you can see it was most common that things were happening 2 times a week, but three was also fairly common, and so was one. So it wasn't that it was only two. There was, a lot of studies used two, some three, some used one, but there's not a clear consensus as to why. Class duration in terms of number of weeks is often somewhere between like around 10 to 12, but again, it's not consistent. And class length most frequently was about an hour, but there are examples that are shorter and examples that are longer. So with the study that's running now, it's trying to determine dose and frequency because people are randomized to take a class once, twice, or 3 times a week, and then looking at onset of benefits and also washout of benefits. And there are four different dance forms, which I'll talk about in a minute. Again, and this is from Rice paper, these are the examples of like the heterogeneity from sample size, population. And one of the ones I really love, and I think we could have a whole lab on this because one of my favorite topics is like, what is a meaningful comparator for dance? So the control group was everything from life as usual, which is nothing, to exercise, education, stretching, doing a different dance form, being on a wait list, or just listening to music. So the control says a lot about what you think or what you're interested in looking at as the active factor in the dance study. So, if you're interested in the impacts, the physical impacts, you might compare to another exercise or physical form. If you're interested in artistic or aesthetic elements, it maybe you're going to have people listen to music. But again, it's not consistent, and the reasons are not always fully clear for why a specific control is used. And then this is just a quick snapshot of all the different outcome measures. So there were many, and then the number along the sides is the number of studies that measured it. So if you look at even just mobility, a lot of people do timed up and go. But is that because it is the most effective thing, or is it because it is easy and standardized and there's good historics for using it? A lot of the studies, there's only one or two studies that use this specific measure. So that means you don't have a lot of things to compare. So that's the background. That's the companion piece. So if you go to the list of references for this paper, I actually found an error when I was getting ready to do this talk. There's a hyperlink to that paper, but you have to use the Google Scholar one because the other ones don't work. The other ones, for some reason, go to a different paper, and I wrote to the editors to correct it. But if you use the Google Scholar hyperlink, you can go and read that paper I just showed you, which is the kind of dry lit review version. Here is the paper where we were like, let's get into the other stuff that is not in the lit review that we think is important and should be there. And I should just point out, I mentioned Jesse and Christina and Christina. The other person on this paper is Jason Fanning, who is a wonderful health and exercise science researcher also at Wake Forest. So just a little bit of a setup here as well. Most of you will also know there has been an exponential increase in research on dance, dance for health, and dance therapy. So this is just a quick PubMed snapshot that I grabbed last night. So on the left is for dance and therapy, the right is dance and health. But you can see we're going from the neighborhood of like, if you go back to 1974, so over the last 50 years, in the 70s and 80s, there was maybe one or two articles being published. that were being listed by PubMed as a research database, but in the last couple of years, it's closer to like 400. So there is a huge increase in published research talking about the impacts of dance therapy and dance for health. And this also relates to a report that was out by the World Health Organization that just came out in the last couple of 2019, which is when we started doing this research. And if you haven't read this, I also highly, highly recommend that you check out this Health Evidence Network Synthesis Report by Fancourt and Finn. And this was calling for policy changes, strengthening lines of referral from healthcare to social care and arts-based interventions. I went through the whole thing and I found over 50 references to dance programs as an example of arts-based things that people could be referred to and their associated benefits. However, there was still a lack of specificity and depth in the reporting parameters, even in what was shared in this particular report. One of the things that I think this is my passion that I care about is that dance is much more than just the movement. So if we think about the outcome measures for what gets measured, things like balance, timed up and go, stuff like that, dance is not only a way to improve our motor capabilities. Dance is and has something that called embodied knowledge. Dance is cultural. Dance is relating to things in our personal expression and history and awareness, but also in our cultural expression and history and awareness. And a lot of times when dance interventions are reporting on what they did or what they included, they will refer to a style of dance without giving a lot of further information. So they might say that it used jazz dance or tango or contemporary, but each one of these forms has cultural connotations, has historical connections, and there are so many different ways that that form can be experienced. There are so many different ways it can be taught, it can be learned, it can be enacted and embodied. And those elements, if we don't know what they are, we actually don't know very much about what happened in the intervention. I think there are an infinite number of ways, even just to teach tango, and for that experience to unfurl in real life. So this is something that I think is really important, and this is one of the things that we tried to get out in this paper to bring to people's awareness and to suggest that they at least try to report on aspects of embodied knowledge and dance. One of the aspects of this paper is that we published a checklist that had a bunch of domains to try to get at that. And this was very much structured and inspired by a paper that was published in 2011 by Rob et al. That was outlining recommendations for reporting on music-based interventions. So they published something trying to get at aspects that needed to be included in music interventions. We basically took their structure and adapted it to create a similar checklist for dance because there had been pretty good uptake and use of the checklist that was published in 2011. So that's also where this structure comes from. So there's seven domains. I will just briefly touch on each of them and why we included them, and then I would love to have a conversation or questions. So the first domain is the rationale for the choice of dance intervention. So we suggest that there should be a clear reason for why that style or form of dance was used. And this could come from references to previous research, so maybe building on, responding to previous research that has used this form and extending it, or saying maybe there's a gap in the research about this form. Maybe there hasn't been any research on this form. And this should include adequate treatment of historical and cultural associations. I think if that is missing, we're missing something important about dance. Again, it's not just movement, it's not just the dance moves like this. It's like, what is the meaning of this form? Does it have a potential meaning register for the participants. And this gets to B is like, is there a hypothesis for how elements of the form may impact specific target outcomes for the study population? So that could be the dance includes a type of movement-based skill that relates to something of interest in the study. So, I mean, for instance, if we take the example of a tango, there's like weight shifting. If you're interested in balance, you know, maybe that's a reason to use this. But also, are you working with a population who has danced this form, you know, earlier in their life that is familiar with it? Or is this a very new form that's bringing a whole different cultural register to people? So, why this dance? Why? Domain two, the interventionist. So this is the person who's leading the dance intervention. There is often very little information about this. And if you have ever studied dance, taken a class, been there, you know this makes a difference. So first of all, what is this person's previous experience with the form used in the intervention? What is their training background and qualifications? So, for instance, in dance therapy research, sometimes it will say that it was a trained dance movement therapist delivering the intervention. And because there is some standardized training for dance movement therapy at the graduate level, we have some sense of what that might mean. But even dance movement therapists have many different modes of practice. So I think there needs to be a bit more information. Anyway, also sometimes people are teaching a form that they're not familiar with. Maybe someone has been brought in as a dance instructor but is being asked to teach something that's not their home form. What does that mean? Do they have experience and knowledge of the participant population? You know, if it's a dance research working with people with Parkinson's, has this person worked with people with Parkinson's before? Are they familiar with the needs of the population? And this one is almost never included in reporting. I have very rarely seen this, that there's a specification of duties and role played in the design and delivery of the intervention. So, the person who is delivering the dance experience, did they help design it? Were they just given a formula and said, here, do this? Were they able to tweak or make suggestions in the study design based on their lived experience? I think this is also an important thing that I don't often see reported. Domain three is pretty simple, just the setting. This is also something that I think makes a difference, is like a description of the space and any challenges or limitations. Was the space difficult for people to get to? Is it accessible? And were there any modifications made to improve people's experience? So, you know, something that's taking place, say, in a noisy public room in a community center or a gymnasium is a very different experience from being in a beautiful dance studio or being somewhere that the setting contributes. Again, if we think about from a dance for health perspective, one of the main ideas is that it's artistry and it's being having an experience with trained teaching artists that sometimes I would argue that the studio itself contributes to people's sense of having an artistic experience. It's very different than if that same dance experience is led in, say, a clinic room. So what is the setting? The structure and framework of the dance intervention. This is something that is reported. So we were able to, in our previous, the companion piece, remember I showed you the thing with the hourglasses of this, the frequency, the duration. So people do report this, it's just not always consistent. And the thing that is missing that we wanted to highlight is that there's a wide range of variability regarding the intensity of the dance intervention. So different styles can be very intense or less intense. You can also take an intense style and modify it or adapt it to be less intense. And different dance traditions have different structures of learning and execution. So movement transmission is not homogeneous. Some dances are led in a circle, some are linear, some have more improvisation, some are more choreographed, some of them are co-created by people in a group, some of them there's an expert model that people are replicating. These are all really different structures for movement transmission. So learning and engaging in the movement is going to be really different depending on these types of things, and they are seldom reported. And if you think about it, if you think in terms of replicability, how can you replicate a movement experience if you don't have this critical information about how it was received? This is related to that domain five movement. The movement vocabulary is also of great importance for replicability. There should be enough detailed descriptions of the potential movement repertoires and how the movement is described in the protocol. So even you could have a fixed movement repertoire, but how much of that movement repertoire did people actually engage in? How much scope was there for individual expression? I mean, in dance movement therapy, we're not looking for one single motor expression. There would be a lot of different ones. But can we contain some information or describe some information about how much people moved? What kinds of movements did they engage in? I think this is very, very important. And one of the suggestions that we put in this paper is the use of a notation system such as LMA, which can really describe and document these different aspects of movement beyond just, a direction or a type of step, but the how of the movement, which is really, really critical. So we have two left. Domain six is music. This is also surprisingly underreported, considering that dance and music have a very close relationship. Tecumseh Fitch has a great paper called Rhythm, Meter, and Groove. And he says that, many languages, music and dance are connoted by a single term. But is the music live? Is it recorded? Was it the same music every class? Even studies where people do the same dance form for several weeks, do they always listen to the same playlist or the same one song, or do they have different music every time? Because that could really make a difference. And also, not all dance is done with music. And this applies to different dance forms, different types of dance engagement, and also even the way it is taught. So there are some forms where there may be a period of learning steps to a count, and there's no music. So even just how much music is played during the time that people are in the intervention and not, because there's also a lot of research now on the impacts of music on the brain and on things like motor control and motor initiation. So I would think that music is a pretty important ingredient that is potentially having an impact on the outcome of the study. And oh, I was just going to, I actually just had another paper come out this week. If you're interested in thinking about dance beyond music, we proposed a way of thinking about dance as mindful movement, as a way of becoming conscious again of the way the movement is rolling out. Last domain, fidelity. So interventionists, and especially teaching artists who maybe have not worked in a research setting before, need to have adequate training that they understand what it means to follow the research protocol. Some protocols will have space where you need or have to make adaptations and improvise. But if you are responsible for delivering the intervention, you need to know which things are critical to stick to the plan, which things can I change, and we still have fidelity to the research design. And also keeping track of things of adaptations, what adaptations are made and why. We make a suggestion that the lead artist or interventionist, the person leading the dance experience, could be considered an equal investigator along with the research team, validating their embodied experience, allowing them to contribute to any changes or adaptations that are made in the protocol. So to close, in there, we say we recognize the fundamentally embodied nature of dance does not always lend itself to lexical description. So words are not always the best way to talk about dance. We call for like multi-platform research. Maybe we need more video-based journals on dance research, because if you see 30 seconds of something on film, it tells you often a lot more than a written description can. there are always going to be challenges in trying to capture something as complex as dance. But these things are important. The things that are difficult are maybe the things that matter most. And capturing what the experience means to the people who have engaged in it is something that I think is absolutely crucial and is an important aspect of dancing. That's it. Hello.
Hello, thank you very much, Rebecca. Yes. My question to you, Teti, we have not prepared this. Have you an icebreaker question for Rebecca so that we go with a question to her and then maybe the other people can come as well? Or are you other people just ready and type your questions into the chat?
So a question I wanted to ask, because Rebecca, thank you for the beautiful presentation, which I think is very broad and touches upon so many themes. And also I find brings a lot of clarity around the practice of dance movement therapy or dance for health. Maybe one first question is about the relationship between these two things. How these two
Yes.
things do they relate in your experience and research?
I think that the first thing, and like working with students, is very clear. In a lot of published research, it's getting better, but for quite a while, dance therapy was used as a catch-all term for this was a dance experience and it had a therapeutic outcome. It's becoming better in the literature that if it is dance movement therapy, it is named as such. And if it is a therapeutic dance experience, it is named more in the field of dance for health. I think IADAMS has done a lot of work with the creation of the Dance for Health Committee and a lot of the things they've published that people now feel like they can say, oh, this was a dance for health thing, or they will name this was dance for PD. They'll name what this is. I think that there are very important differences in the way that the experience is framed, in the intent, in the way it is conducted, in the interventionist, in all of these things. And the reasons that someone would be interested in exploring dance movement therapy versus dance for health would depend on the questions, the populations, so all of these parameters that we tried to spell out. I feel that there are benefits to both of these approaches. As someone who's had training in both, I say I wear both hats. And I like to be able to draw on what is the best approach for this person or these people in front of me. This is from a practice lens. It's like, what is the best way to move forward? What is the goals? What is our context? What is our contract? But I would love to see both fields become more aware of each other, more aware of similarities, differences, tools, techniques, so that we can be aware of possibilities for people. So also, even whether we're working with a research team or with a group of clients or an artistic invitation, we're able to say, you know what, this is like a really great place to bring in something from dance therapy or dance for health. And also to be able to say, this is my expertise is here or here. Who could we ask to, enlarge our expertise in one or the other? Why are we using this approach? What is our expected outcome? I think that just broadening the knowledge of and between these fields would really strengthen dance research in general that aims to have a, let's just call it a good outcome for people, whether it's therapeutic or health, a good outcome.
And the other thing about the paper, I really love the title, This Time with Feeling. And then as you described all these domains, I kind of wondered so you made a premise that about dance as knowledge and dance as feeling, there's in the title of the paper. When you describe these domains, how do feelings come about? What is the domain that captures them, or what are domains that relate to that level of movement becoming dance, this time with
Yeah.
feeling?
That's a beautiful question. I think what we tried to capture, because you can't, the feelings aren't the input, the feeling would be the output. So we tried to capture what are the inputs that lead to that. And so things like the use of music is something like, I was just at Dance for PD and they always use a live accompanist, and it's the company accompanist. So the teacher just starts to count in and someone starts playing something like amazing on the piano. And even just listening to that music is already like so beautiful and effective, which is very different than someone, having a tiny little speaker playing the same song over and over again. It's like there's a world of difference there. So like music is an input that could lead to an enhanced or different feeling. The style of the intervention, the comfort of the person leading it, the space for engagement. One of the things that I loved about this special call is that all of the articles in this special edition in some way touch on agency, sense of agency, which is also, I believe, very important in this, because what are the elements that go in that allow someone within the experience to have a greater sense of agency in relation to what's happening? Because I think that's the thing, that this time with feeling, it's like you're not just marking the movements, like, okay, yeah, this is what we're doing. It's like I am inhabiting the movements. I am really fully embodied and bringing them to life and putting myself in them. And that is evoking more of a feeling sense for me and potentially for the people I am dancing with.
I think this is very, this is a lot of potential to think about the mystic, to capture the mystic. Yeah. But any questions from the participants? Would you please write the question into the chat?
Could I also speak? It
Yeah,
might
I
be
think
easier. Yeah.
if we're doing a podcast transcription, it would be okay. What do you think, Brigitte?
Well, Sabrina, you should give us then your signature that we can publish it because we hear your voice. We have rather strong laws in Switzerland for that. That's actually the reason why we wanted it in the chat, that we do not have to do that paper cram, that paper stuff.
Okay.
So, but now
Okay.
go ahead, Sabrina. Now you are here.
Yeah, I'm fine to have published my voice. Yeah, thank you very much for this nice presentation. I think it's really interesting to see how you combine dance with Alzheimer's as well, and maybe trying to prevent the outbreak or slow down the progression, I think, right? So this might be like a goal. So I was wondering, because you've been talking about outcomes as well, are you using validated questionnaires where you're asking the patient population what kind of outcomes are you wishing to achieve and then try to adapt your intervention accordingly?
Yeah, that is a great question. So I've done a bit of both with the study that I was talking about, the group at Wake Forest. It's through Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. So they have like a full-on memory clinic. They have access to all of the validated scores. So they're using MMSE and all of the standardized measures, but they're also doing fMRI. So we're doing like some brain imaging as well. It is more, I would say, based on, even in the current study, they're doing peak VO2. So they're doing a lot of standardized biometric assessments along with biological signatures like neuroimaging. And that is one way of achieving the translation on the types of things that medical professionals might be looking at as having a meaningful output. And there is importance in that because that is demonstrating value in the language of the specialization that is treating these people as a patient population. But I've also done a bit of work in Canada that's more participant oriented and patient led. And I actually just put in a grant application to do a bit, go even further with this and talk to people about what do they think is happening? What is the meaningful thing for them? And then reverse the challenge to the research team and say, okay, how do we measure that? How do we measure this magic? Because I think it's easy to say, as a research team, we have this set of tools, we have this battery of tests, this has been validated, so let's use this. But I've also seen some really beautiful research designs come up with a null result, or like something that is non-statistically significant because what is being measured is maybe not the thing that really mattered. And I think validating that participant experience and people saying this is what I feel changed, and figuring out, well, how can we account for that? And then I think there's another step, which is like bringing those two types of information together. Like, how can we do some translation from a specially designed research protocol to try to measure the magic and correlate it with something like an MMSE or a biometric output, so that we have that translation to the to researchers and people working as clinicians.
Yeah, thank you very much. Because I think the first thing is, right, what do patients want to achieve? And then the other one, how can we measure if we achieved it and to prove it and then maybe get some reimbursement or whatever to really have it valued?
Yeah, lovely question. Very important.
Thank you very much.
So I would like, thank you, Sabrina. I would like to ask you the last question, Rebecca. A very
Okay.
simple question, but I want to kind of like close the circle to the research practice transfer. So what if you stood in front of a cohort? They have had like half a year training. They have learned a little bit Laban, Batenieff movement system, or LMA. They have had psychohygiene. They have had a little bit of the knowledge of salutogenesis. What would you, when you present them your paper, give them advice for most important things for a practice transfer, for application of dance therapy?
I would suggest that people going forward, students going forward, have a bit of an eye to things like ethnographic research practices, where they are observing and tracking elements of the experience. Because even just for their practice, to notice in the future, what was the impact of using music in this particular way, or that group was really great, or it really wasn't that great. But like, what was the room like? That was that, these all of these domains, they're relevant for research, but they can also help inform us of some of the aspects of doing a practice, whether it's dance for health or dance therapy, that could have an influence on the outcome, on the feeling that emerges. So I would think, as a first standpoint, just in practice, to be aware of these things so that they could be reported, they could help inform the development of your practice. And then anyone who wants to work with a research team or has the opportunity to work with a research team would have some fluency to be able to describe important aspects that they want to make sure are included in the reporting of the research or in the development of the protocol.
Could you imagine that this could lead to some kind of a assessment structure?
Very good question. Like an assessment structure for the quality of research or an assessment structure in practice?
In practice, That we say, okay, we have this domain and this and this and this is important of that domain. And this is important for of the other domain, or research says that and that has really a good outcome from that from the third domain, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a first step, it could be a way to determine if you are thinking really holistically about your practice. So it could be a way, kind of a practice assessment. Have I considered things in all of these domains? And then, yes, I think the dream would be, as we develop an evidence base that can be clearly applied, to be able to say, well, I know within the music domain, here's some of the research I know, and this is going to inform the choices that I make. And if I make a different choice, at least I'm in conversation with the research. Like, I'm intentionally doing something different, maybe because of something I'm thinking about in this domain. And then I could say, How did that influence the outcome? And then I would have a framework, I guess, for at least reporting on that.
Yeah, and Brigitte, what you probably were also thinking of, it sounds a lot like the outcomes framework that was developed in Australia by Kim Dumphy and her colleagues. That I think it's a nice complementary tool to what Rebecca was just describing. Because that tool was really created about clinical domains and so that create both a structure for a session and also outcome measures. And what Rebecca was describing is, I think, also has to do with the larger container of how do we do things. So things like the two of them are nice complementary tools or perspectives that describe the way we think when we design and deliver
Yes. And
clinical.
on that note, I do want to say that going back to the questions Brigitte asked me at the beginning, it is astonishing how hard it is to publish something on how to think. People only want results, but if we don't think about how we think, we risk just repeating bad results.
So for me, just that last discussion was very inspiring because I'm always thinking, how can we train our students evidence-oriented? And this definitely, these two scales could do some kind of contribution. So I think we have a lot of food to think. Yeah, and we are just hoping that all of you are inspired, as I was wishing when we started. Like from you to Cecilia and Rebecca, one like a last sentence, like an overview sentence to close our first and historic session.
Make sure you do it
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all for being here. Very, very happy to see people joining this conversation. I see a hug from Raimonda.
Yes, thank you. Merci beaucoup. Thank you for people who came. And we also had an international, many languages type audience. So also thank you for listening. I don't know if English is the first language for anyone except for me. So thank you for listening in English. And I hope I didn't talk too fast and you could follow.
We hope to see you next time
Thank
in March, and we wish you a very beautiful weekend.
you. You
So,
too. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Bye.
you.
Bye,
Bye-bye.
Brigitte. Thank
In
you.
March. Hope to see you in March for the next presentation.
Okay. Okay. Ciao, Cecilia.